You're very welcome to this election special here on RTÉ Radio 1 on day 3 of the election count. And in the last 10 minutes, we finally have the last two seats of the 174 seats now filled. That is a final and complete tally of seats around the country, with those final two seats closing in on Fianna Fáil in Cavan, Monaghan. And we're going to get to a lot of analysis of those seats and all the permutations of government as Fianna Fáil lands out with the biggest number of seats of 48, Sinn Féin tallying at 39 and Fine Gael at 38. We have live in Cavan, Monaghan, where the count has been ongoing up until about 10 minutes ago. Maura Fay, our reporter on the ground. It was 4:30 this morning. Good morning, Maura. When you got the first TD elected, you now have all five TDs finally elected in Cavan, Monaghan.
Yes, Anya. So after 43 hours of sorting ballots, a long wait for a first count, followed by 13 more counts, 658 spoiled votes, the distribution of three surpluses, two miraculous medals recovered from ballot boxes and a lot of coffee, we have whittled down the field of 20 candidates and elected the final two TDs of the 2024 general election. They are Brendan Smith and Niamh Smith of Fianna Fáil. And just in case anyone was wondering, they are not related. In fact, they spell Smith differently.
A lot of Smiths and a lot of O'Reillys on that long ballot paper, which was adding to just how slow it was making everything.
Oh, definitely, yes. We had hoped that things would be wrapped after count 13 earlier this evening, but such was the size of Sinn Féin's Cathy Bennett's surplus after transfers from her party colleague Matt Carthy, it became a mathematical possibility that Sarah O'Reilly of Aintu could be elected if she received practically every transfer from Bennett. So a further count proceeded. After count 14, which was announced a short time ago, Niamh Smith was deemed elected on 11,058 votes, slightly ahead of Brendan Smith, who was deemed elected on 10,886 votes, neither of them reaching the quota of 11,542. Sarah O'Reilly of Aintu finished in sixth spot on 10,067 votes. Now, Anya, for people who are fans of how the single transferable vote system works, it's interesting to note that only three of the five TDs who had the highest number of first preferences on count one were elected. That's Sinn Féin's Matt Carthy and Cathy Bennett and Fianna Fáil's Brendan Smith. Robbie Gallagher of Fianna Fáil and Pauline Tully of Sinn Féin fell out of the top five position as the transfers came in, while David Maxwell of Fine Gael and Niamh Smith of Fianna Fáil moved up the rankings as candidates were eliminated.
And we can hear some of the speeches happening in the background now. I reckon that's Niamh Smith we can hear, and hopefully we might talk to
Cathy
her.
Bennett.
Oh, it's Cathy Bennett.
Niamh Smith will be next giving her speech.
Excellent.
Followed by Brendan
Smith.
So we
might talk to our winning candidates there in a little while. How do you think the post-mortem is playing out there, Maura? Obviously Fianna Fáil had a three candidate strategy, as did Sinn Féin. Cathy Bennett was only added a month ago by Sinn Féin. They already had the sitting TDs Tully and Matt Carthy in play, but with the retirement of Heather Humphreys, they decided to add a third with Bennett, who was a sitting councillor, but she's now unseated.
Yes,
her Sinn Féin colleague.
Yeah, a small number of votes. If things had gone slightly different in transfers, she could have, Sinn Féin could have had three seats here. Back in 2020, the party got 36 first preferences, and they would have had a much stronger chance of getting three candidates elected that time. This time around, they got just about 33% of first preferences, so it just made that three-candidate strategy very difficult. I know Pauline Tully is very upset to have lost her seat, understandably, but it's the nature of politics. And I think Matt Carthy was saying earlier that, you know, the party wants to affect change, and in order to do that, they need to have bold strategies.
So Fianna Fáil, the happier of the parties tonight, you reckon? Do you think it's relief there that they've gotten two sitting TDs back in, helped by the third candidate there in the senator?
Yes, right. So what's interesting to note is that the two Fianna Fáil TDs are both from Cavan. Robbie Gallagher was from Monaghan, so I know the Monaghan side of the Fianna Fáil grouping are disappointed that Robbie didn't get the second Fianna Fáil seat here. But I think that Niamh Smith is quite happy. She, I think, was in eighth position when the first preferences came in. So I think she's quite happy to, you know, moved up the rankings and actually finished ahead of Brendan Smith, her party colleague.
Well, thank you for all the reporting. Moira, you are the last woman standing across all of the constituencies tonight after a lot of pizza and fish suppers and coffees. Thank you for your service there. I hope my native Monaghan have been very hospitable towards you, and safe travels on from there.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Very
Anya.
Good. Well done. Thank you for that, Moira, for all the reporting from Cavan Monaghan. And as we said at the top of the show, that gives us a final count on the 174 seats are now all filled. And I might go to Paul Hosford, who joins me here in studio, Deputy Political Editor with the Irish Examiner. Paul, we know the numbers now. Fianna Fáil out in the lead there with 48 seats, Sinn Féin 39, Fine Gael 38. Who's talking to who today? Are all the permutations scenarios starting to play out on who will form the next government?
At the minute, nobody's talking because everyone's wrecked. I was looking at Mick Barry, who conceded in Cork North Central, the outgoing People for Profit Solidarity TD, and somebody asked him how he's feeling, and he said he's fine, he's just tired. Everyone over the weekend, Maura's count in Cavan Monaghan has just gone on and on. After a weekend like that, 3 weeks sprint to get there, everyone wants to just take a day or two.
Take down the posters.
Parliamentary party meetings in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will take place, I think, Wednesday for both this point. At that point, you'll start to kind of get the sense known about what people want, what people think about a future Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael coalition. Mary Lou McDonald has reached out to Labour and the Social Democrats today about forming a government, but I mean, Labour doesn't seem to want to talk this early. They've always said that their preference is to speak to the Social Democrats and speak to the Greens about this centre-left grouping, this shared platform. I think generally there's not much I suppose there's just not much appetite within Labour to have that conversation, because the numbers just aren't there. When you look at what Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are going to come back with in the next all, it's 86. They're one.
What do we think the magic number is? Do you think they need to get to the mid-90s? Like, we know 88 is where you needed to get to just to be at the edge, but to have comfort and contingency over 5 years?
I think it depends what your makeup is. If you were taking Labour and you had 11 and you had 97, you'd be absolutely chuffed because you can do business with a party. If you're taking independence, you would accept 94, 95, but you would kind of want to bolster that. You're going to get support from the sidelines, from the likes of Michael Lowry or maybe Noel Grealish. So that puts you at majority anyway, but then you've got other independents who are not just amenable to supporting your budgets or passing your legislation, but they'll actually want to be active participants in government. Sean Canny has already said that he would do that. Boxer Moran has already said that he would do that.
Kingmakers. Kevin Cunningham, thank you for joining us, founder of Ireland Thinks and lecturer in politics at TU Dublin. You've obviously had days pouring over the exit poll that we had on Friday night. You're looking now at our final count, seats filled, 174. When you reflect on the poll that we had on Friday night and how the numbers now look tonight, you know, like, exit poll Friday night was showing Sinn Féin getting the highest percentage of votes at 21.1. It seemed to underestimate Fianna Fáil, overestimated Sinn Féin. When you compare the exit poll to the reality tonight, what's the difference? And maybe why was the exit poll out and definitely wrong in some instances?
Yeah, hi Anya. I mean, the difference, I guess, first of all, would be that Fianna Fáil were about 2.4% too low, Sinn Féin 2% too high. The other parties weren't actually that far out. You know, I mean, I think Fine Gael was pretty much spot on. Labour was okay. People for Profit, Ain't Too, all seemed fine. I think the reason why it is accentuated, or at least a very prominent sort of a difference relative to the outcome, is partly because of the tightness of the race itself. You know, we've had sort of referendums in the past, like, say, the repeal of the eighth one, where that was off by maybe the exit poll itself, was off by about 3%. But it wasn't something that was as much of a focus because it was pretty much a landslide victory for the yes side in that particular case. So I think what sometimes happens is when an exit poll is slightly off and the race itself is quite tight, then obviously we start to ask questions. And I think it's also accentuated by the very fact that Fianna Fáil have had this enormous seat bonus in terms of getting 26 or 27% of the seats on just 22% of the vote. So Fianna Fáil's kind of lead, I guess, is accentuated by how things have panned out, certainly in terms of the seats themselves. But polling itself, I guess, I wouldn't like, I guess it's sounding like I'm saying it's not in a crisis in some way, because, you know, even the three polls that were conducted in the final week were all sort of also within 1% or less.
And do you think it's something in the model, you know, when we look at this was lower turnout, we'll have to see what the final figure comes at, but we're looking at something like 59.7%. So is it something to do with turnout for that model? Is it that the turnout amongst younger people seems to have been down? Is it that maybe people don't trust pollsters the same way they maybe did 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and therefore that's skewing the demographics, how we measure who we're actually hearing from on a Friday in an exit poll of this nature versus the numbers we're looking at tonight?
Yeah, and you've really highlighted the two major difficulties with polling in general. One is just that some people won't participate, and you have to obviously try and adjust the polls to account for that. You know, there's certain types of voters that might be less likely to participate. And then turnout is an important factor, and it's one of the reasons why referendums are kind of sometimes more difficult to predict. There's an interesting study which shows the relationship between polling error and turnout, in that when the turnout is lower, it becomes more difficult to approximate, because we're not necessarily trying to make it representative of the national population, but rather the subset of the population that actually turns out and vote. So I think probably, you know, if I was looking at the exit poll, I did remember kind of looking at the data when it came out and the age demographics, and I thought it looked a little bit younger than maybe you might have expected in terms of what you might expect from sort of the typical distribution of voters in an election. But that could have been the case anyway. So, you know, I guess when you're doing an exit poll, you're in this big dilemma. Do you adjust it to what you think turnout is going to look like in terms of the age distribution, or do you allow the exit poll itself to determine that? I mean, the purer way of doing it is to say, well, look, we'll just see who actually does it, and then, you know, assume that that's actually the, because, you know, different people might turn out in different elections, and, you know, trying to capture that is quite tricky.
Suzanne Rogers, policy analyst with Social Justice Ireland, to bring you on the exit poll, I'm sure you've been poring over it in terms of, you can see there the people who are voting Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, obviously the economy was a huge motivation for them. The cost of living issues, inflation, that seemed to be across the three parties. From your vantage point tonight, when you look at those seats, the permutations, the formation of the next government, do you think cost of living, social injustices, inequality, fairness, do you think you're going to get better answers in the next government formulations?
The word that kept cropping up all the way through this was change. And if I cast my mind back to my intercert French, was it plus ça change, le même chose? It's like things change, but things stay the same. So I keep going back to the manifestos, because what's in the manifestos will be what's in programme for government. And it's that space where I'm not really sure that we're seeing the change that is being promised. So it's more of the same. Like if we go back to sort of, you know, 2020, that was housing, that was services. We've added cost of living into that. We really need to move away from more of the same. So I don't think that there doesn't seem to be anything in the manifestos that is breaking with what we currently have. And I was sort of like, you know, kind of just joking beforehand. It's a little bit like, you know, the bad boyfriend or the bad girlfriend. We've been together for 5 years. I know I haven't put the bins out. I know I keep leaving empty milk cartons in the fridge, but, you know, give me one more chance, baby. I can change. So I don't know whether we're really seeing the radical things in those manifestos that need to be done to deliver on the housing, the services, the infrastructure. And again, if we go back to the amount of money we have, the budgets that we have, the headlines that we have, we're at a full employment. We can argue what that means later on. But I don't know what we're doing with this money, because, again, we still have this huge cohort of people who are no better off when we look at the legacy of the last 5 years, when we look at the last budget. So many households in poverty, so many households living in deprivation. CSO are going to come out with new figures in the middle of January. They'll be very interesting to see.
Staying with this question of how much is changing, to bring you in, Brian Sheehan, CEO, Women for Election. Obviously, this was a change in quotas this time around for political parties striving to hit the 40% representation in terms of their female candidates. As you look at the data tonight, Brian, and try to kind of understand, will this next door look and feel and sound differently? Are there more women walking through the gates of Leinster House in 2 weeks' time when they start to take their seats in a new Dáil?
Yes, there is, and that is something that we should celebrate. And the other thing we should celebrate is that more women ran than ever before ran in an election, 50% more than ran in 2020. So what you see is there is a huge appetite growing among women across the country to represent their communities and represent what they believe and get to the Dáil. The system isn't great at incorporating women or incorporating change. There's 44 women walking through the Dáil. I think 23 or 24 of those are newly elected, and they'll be a quarter of all the TDs. Now, that's progress from the last Dáil, but it's kind of small progress. We go from 23 to 25%. But it's certainly an indication that women are talented, capable women, are ready, willing and able to lead. We have to make the system work for them.
Some of the analysis here in this studio on this programme last night, Brian, was around some women just being added too late to tickets and just questions arising about, are we taking seriously the pipeline of councillors that are there now, giving them the adequate supports? And we know all the issues when it comes to sometimes childcare, women worried about online physical harassment and online abuse. Like, what are some of the issues as you see it tonight? Yes, more women returning, and as you say, some of them are first-time TDs, but what are still some of the barriers to entry for women in politics?
I suppose there's a couple of them, and the biggest one is probably political strategy. You talked earlier about Cathy Bennett and how she was added late based on Heather Humphrey's going. So sometimes people are added late to tickets, and it's very good the way it comes out. Obviously, for Pauline Tully, it wasn't the way that fleshed out. I suppose the biggest challenge that women face, all the other things you mention are true, is actually incumbency. The biggest advantage to for somebody running for election is to be an incumbent. I'll do the final calculations later, but I think 9 people have got elected who have never held office before, who are not an outgoing TD or senator or a councillor. So what then you find is that incumbency being the biggest advantage, how do you get to be an incumbent? And because women are at just a quarter of our local authorities and lead around a quarter of the Dáil, it's very hard to break through in that context. I think there's a number of things that can be done to tackle that one. There's other things we can do. But there's about 50 councillors have been elected. And if political parties are serious, it's a test of their commitment. Would they consider women-only shortlists for the selection conventions for co-options to replace those councillors, which will all be done in about 2 weeks' time? And that is a mark of whether the political establishment is really serious about addressing the gender balance, as you said, building that pipeline so more women can get into local government now, so that when the local elections come around in 5 years' time, they're already incumbents, they're already able to make a pitch to be re-elected, and then maybe to move on to the Dáil or Shannon after that.
Just finally, Brian, do you think women put up with the same level of online abuse, physical harassment, threats, bullying, as maybe we've seen in local elections, European elections, and has been documented in so many different pieces of research over the last 5 years, based on very personal experiences of TDs, senators, councillors around the country?
You're right, Anya, it is really difficult. I think we're in a particular world where anybody who's in the public eye is has abuse thrown at them, and some or other, it's been normalised. It's always underpinned, though, by sexism and misogyny and homophobia and transphobia and racism. And we haven't figured out how to tackle that. So, yes, women do face much worse abuse online than men, it isn't that men don't. But one of the things that I think is important to remember is that it isn't putting women off. Of course, it's a challenge that women have to cope with, that all women in public life have to cope with. But it is a barrier to people who think they might like to get into politics, because mostly what happens is their family says, I mean, are you mad, right? So we have to work on that. But I suppose the important thing to say about all that is the vast majority of candidates, the vast majority of times, have respectful interactions at the door. Somebody, you'll knock at a door and somebody might say, I wouldn't have anything to do with you because you're a political allegiance or whatever. And that's OK. That's political debate. It's when it crosses that line. So we have to figure out, as a society, we have to figure out how do we make, how do we keep those lines? How do we keep safety in public life? Otherwise, we'll end up with people who are the toughest people in positions where we also need people who have empathy and understanding. And it's a real trick that we haven't figured out how to do it, and that social media has kind of exceeded what we were the norms of political debate for quite a long time.
Okay, well, Brian Sheehan, CEO of Women for Elections, I know you've done a lot of work there to have a moment tonight where you can say more women will walk through the gates of Leinster House, I think, on December 18th. So well done to you and the team there. Suzanne, to bring you in on that, Suzanne Rogers, policy analyst with Social Justice Ireland, in terms of the makeup of this doll, when you look at the 174 TDs on December 18th. What's your impressions of the communities that they serve, the backgrounds they come from, the diversity, the inclusiveness, the gender breakdown? Do you think it's more inclusive, diverse doll than the one that went before?
Again, it doesn't, you know, when we talk about change, that's not really what we're seeing. I mean, the figures I had jotted down before I left the house were 41 women out of 171 seats. So obviously that changed in the drive across here. It's still quite a low number, and I appreciate there were record candidates, but I agree with you. I mean, I fair play to any woman who puts herself. I mean, the bit of abuse we probably get is tiny compared to what you would be getting if you were to put yourself into that sort of arena. But again, it's about, you know, if you're there to represent a community, your community is really, really diverse. Like the Dublin suburb I live in is exceptionally diverse. You name it, it's there. Like every permutation, do you know what I mean? Every type, shape, colour, creed of person is there. My neighbours, the people my child goes to school with. That's not what I saw reflected back.
You see that more in locals and Europeans. And granted, in the locals, you just simply have the ability to run more candidates and see people coming in who might be migrants, newly settled in Ireland. That doesn't cut through in the general election.
But even with the general election, like there were 16 candidates on the ballot that I went to vote on Friday, and I got it down as far as 6 and I had to stop. So even within the diversity that was, you know, on the ballot paper, it was like I can't really go any further than this. But if you look again, you know, kind of going back to what's in their programmes, and when I looked at, say, you know, what women will get out of it, I look at sort of something like, I just did a very crude control F for poverty, for childcare. And it's really, 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 I suppose, front and centre who's actually looking at these issues and who isn't looking at these issues. Like, there are manifestos that don't mention childcare. There are manifestos that don't mention poverty at all.
Well, one of the women who is boosting those numbers that we've been looking at and talking about is Cathy Bennett, who is now elected in the Cavan Monaghan constituency, and she joins us from there. Congratulations to you, Cathy Bennett, on taking one of those final seats in the longest running count in the country for Sinn Féin tonight. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's been an honour.
How are you feeling there tonight?
I'm completely humbled. You know, got a massive vote there in the end, and it's just completely down to the people of Cavan at Monaghan that have put their trust in me. It was a short campaign. We ran a very good campaign. I had a great team around me. And I have to say, I'm just very, very humbled to have did so well, you know, on my first outing. So I just want to thank the Cavan and Monaghan constituency for their support. I will work hard for you and I'll do my very best.
And Cathy, what was the calculation a month ago? Was it that you spotted an opportunity, Heather Humphreys retiring, it wasn't expected, Sinn Féin decided let's run three and try and win three. So was that the opening and the opportunity? And were you confident that there could be three? What's happened tonight, though, is that you've ultimately unseated, though, your Sinn Féin colleague, the TD Tully there in Cavan. So, yeah, can you talk to us a little bit about the strategy at play?
Yeah. So I suppose we went into this with three candidates and we were hoping to get three elected. I suppose we don't know that Pauline had... there's a lot of candidates in her field and unfortunately... On this time, Pauline didn't get elected, but we said, and I said it today, we'll be going again the next time for the tree again, and hopefully we will get the tree elected the next time. It was just, we don't know, like the votes were down a wee bit as well. I don't know whether that's down to the electorate, you know, whether there was a less of a turnout at this election. So I suppose we're just kind of, like Pauline had Cavan and myself and Matt divided Monaghan. So that was our strategy and we thought it would work with the numbers from the last time. So and it's just bitterly disappointing, you know, yeah. For Pauline and that she's been a great TD. And we will, myself and Matt, will continue to work with Pauline throughout this term. Pauline will still be here in Cavan and myself and Matt will be in Cavan and Monaghan also. So we'll continue to work and continue on the great work that Pauline has did during her term.
So you'll go again with the three candidate strategy whenever yes. another election will follow. But what do you think with the trend lines there, Cathy Bennett? Do you think Monaghan people kept their vote from Matt Carty on to you and it stayed within county boundary lines?
Yeah, I do believe we were doing the tallies here on, it seems a long time ago now, on Saturday morning. And we definitely seen a trend that Cavan based people, or were staying with the Cavan candidates and Monaghan was staying with the Monaghan candidates throughout all the parties. So there was, you know, I did think Sinn Féin had a great strategy in that we were asking for 1, 2 and 3, and we've seen that a lot on all the ballot papers that we've been tallied in the morning time. So I do believe it was just the amount of people in the field for Pauline. I think there was, I'm just thinking offhand, 21 altogether. I think it was 13 in the Cavan side and 8 on the Monaghan side. So I believe that's why Pauline's votes were divided down so much.
And for you going into the Dáil now, you've been a councillor, you're a first time TD, Cathy Bennett. What's the one thing you'd like to get done now over this Dáil term?
Yeah, well, I definitely like to see more services for disabilities. It's been a big issue that has been raising its head throughout counties Monaghan and Cavan over the last Dáil term. And it's something that we have been very... you know, aggressive on, and we want to ensure that that happens and to ensure that the people with children with disabilities are looked after. So that would be one of the items. I'd also like to see more funding for roads in Monaghan and Cavan. That's another issue that has been raising its head all the time. Like, I don't feel that the county councils are getting enough money for roads within our constituencies. And the other item would be, for me, childcare. There's not enough childcare facilities. Parents are struggling daily. Parents are paying as much of a nearly equivalent to a mortgage in childcare. So Sinn Féin had a policy that we wanted to get through in the Dáil where it would only be €10 per day for childcare, and that's something that I'm very... Well, I'd like to see happen.
You've a long list there to get
I have,
through.
And well, plenty more too.
Yeah. Congratulations to you, Cathy Bennett of Sinn Féin, taking a seat there in Cavan Monaghan. And I think beside Cathy Bennett, or maybe on the line, we have Niamh Smith also in the Cavan Monaghan constituency there tonight, taking one of the two Fianna Fáil seats alongside her colleague Brendan Smith. So that's two Fianna Fáil seats there, two Sinn Féin, one Fine Gael seat, closing out the five seats. Congratulations to you, Niamh Smith. You're heading back to the Dáil. How are you feeling tonight?
Oh, how am I feeling? It's been a roller coaster 72 hours on you, to be honest with you. A few hairy moments in it. But anyway, I'm the other side of it, thankfully, and so, so privileged and really overcome by the fact that I am getting the opportunity to represent people across this constituency for a third term.
I'd say you'll have a persuasive argument to make to Micheál Martin, given the numbers overall tonight, Niamh Smith, 48 seats for Fianna Fáil. You've taken home two Fianna Fáil seats there in the constituency. You've been a chair of an Oireachtas committee. Are you going to be looking to become a minister for Cavan Monaghan, maybe the media portfolio and these negotiations to follow?
Well, you're absolutely right, Aine. The last 5 years certainly was a learning experience and a learning curve for me in chairing the Oireachtas Committee. And of course, I would always be ambitious, not for myself, but for the constituency of Cavan Monaghan. And I think it's really important that the border area has somebody at Cabinet. And I will be always available to offer my services to the leader, Micheál Martin. But of course, we all know that the leader has, I suppose, the gift of it, of, you know, the positions that he, but I suppose truthfully we're a long way off from that, but
like,
of course
you'd
I would be
communications
ambitious.
Media, one that you've a lot of experience and expertise in now.
Yeah, well, I come from an arts background. I'm an art teacher by trade, I suppose, and went to NCAD. What a huge interest in the arts myself, and as you said, the experience of the Oireachtas Committee and the importance really of media, and the impact that social media platforms are having, the establishment of Commission Amann, all of those things are things I really had the opportunity to get my teeth stuck into with the online safety media piece as well. So I would be, as I said, I feel experienced now and well briefed in all of those areas, but whatever the leader may feel, if he calls me to do any particular role, or
I'll be more than willing.
And
Niamh, granted, you've been stuck in account for 3 days, but here in the world of commentary, we've been speculating a lot on will there be a rotating Taoiseach? Will Fianna Fáil have more seats at Cabinet, given that it has moved ahead, you know, by 10, 11 seats there on Fine Gael tonight? Do you think there should be a rotating Taoiseach, or would you like to see different terms and conditions attached to any future maybe negotiation between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for another government?
Well, I suppose, Aine, we have seen what we thought of would have been the impossible with the last government, which was the coming together and the meeting of minds of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. I'm sure Micheál Martin will set out his stall and speak to leaders of all parties and from there decide possibly on what his red lines are in terms of the roles or positions that he wishes to achieve. So I, of course, we're always ambitious for the party itself, and having achieved the number of seats that we have, 2 of 50 is an incredible result. We're now the largest party in Dáil Éireann, and I think that will bring it certain expectations from the leader, Micheál Martin, and his negotiating team, whoever that might be.
Enjoy the celebrations there, Niamh Smith, Brendan Smith, and
thank
to Cathy
much,
Bennett on the last 3 seats in the final count across the country, coming there from Monaghan, Cavan. Kevin Cunningham, to bring you back in, founder of Ireland Thinks, lecturer in politics at TU Dublin. We were talking about gender and diversity. As you look, I suppose, at the poll of polls, as you look at the exit poll, is there anything in there that gives us any indications about how people were thinking about their vote when it came to male, female candidates on ballot papers?
No, it's actually, I mean, it was something I'm actually sort of looking at the minute, trying to infer the extent to which there might be some variation, even within parties, in terms of the extent to which supporters of some parties might be more willing to vote for female or male candidates. I think the existing research suggests that as Brian said earlier, I guess incumbency is the main limiting factor to this particular ability for people to access the political system more generally. Is that one of the kind of major barriers, I think, is that our local elections, which is a route to the Dáil really, happen relatively infrequently. We have them every 5 years, and I think compared to other European countries, that's actually not that frequent, I guess, which means that in some sense the pool of people that enter the political arena is actually quite limited in some respect. A lot of the kind of younger people who are involved in politics would be, you know, would often have got involved at a very young age. The last two Taoiseach, I guess, Simon Harris and Leo Varadkar would have been kind of very heavily involved with, you know, their political party when they were students as well. And I kind of wonder if we had easier access to the political system, then, you know, you might have people who might enter politics at a later age as well as females, obviously. I just feel like in general, access to the political system is actually quite limited, which kind of has an impact as well.
Paul Hosford of the Irish Examiner, what's your sense of how the quota has worked, particularly that jump to 40% this time around? Have political parties embraced it? Have you seen a pattern there of late add-ons of female candidates?
Embrace implies that the attitude is warm. The attitude from a lot of political parties is that it's something that needs to be met, but you would do it by, you know, I suppose just stuffing the ticket in the final days. I know of one candidate from a major party, a local election candidate, who was basically told in the run-up to the election that they would be on the ticket if the gender quota went one way or the other, and to kind of just sit tight and whatever way it shook out would be the decision-making. I think last week, the day before we went to the polls, Thursday, Simon Harris's last stop, one of his last stops on his round the country running around New Energy tour, was a school in Lucan, a girls' school, St. Joseph's. And he gave a he did doorstep with us, and then he went in and he spent about an hour. It was kind of odd to watch because he spent an hour and a half of the last few hours of campaigning sitting talking to teenage girls, most of whom didn't have a vote. There was about 100 of them, 120 of them in the hall. About 30 of them raised their hands when he asked who had a vote, and he really engaged with their questions, really intelligent questions. I was really, really impressed with them. One of the girls asked him a question about what politics could do to tackle racism and discrimination. And it really struck me because I looked around the room and I realised that a good chunk of that room won't see what's in that room reflected back in this doll. There'll be 43 women. All of the 174 candidates will be white. There'll be nobody. I don't think there's anyone born outside of Ireland off the top of my head. There'll be nobody with a pronounced disability. You know, even the sectors that they come from are very narrow. Solicitors, farmers, teachers. And that's not to say that these people don't bring skills. It's just what Kevin was talking about access. The accessibility of politics in Ireland is really, really low. It's hard to attract people in because, you know, we haven't rectified pay for councillors. We haven't made that a full-time job. So if you're in a position where you can treat it as a full-time job, you have an inherent advantage. You can become an incumbent and you can keep the seat, and you can run for the Dáil, and you can become a Dáil incumbent and keep that seat because you're able to treat it as a full-time job.
And that question posed by a teenager to Taoiseach Simon Harris about what governments and politicians can do when it comes to race and discrimination is something Kieran O'Connor, senior analyst with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. This is something you look at a lot, Kieran, in terms of particularly online hate, harassment. What have you been seeing in terms of the general trend lines online over the last 5 weeks leading up to Election Day?
Yeah, evening, Anya. During the past 5 weeks, we've watched candidates and canvassers be harassed, threatened and verbally abused in a joint investigation that ourselves and the Hope and Courage Collective put out. We documented 55 incidents like this, encompassing politically violence motivated threats, harassment, targeting, smears across a spectrum of activity offline but also online. What we found with these 55 incidents, being one of the most notable findings, was that 90% of all incidents featured social media in some form, so illustrating the central role that online platforms occupy in the hate, harassment or targeting of candidates in particular.
And in all of that, Kieran, with the offline harassment and then online harassment, when you compare back to locals and Europeans, where it did feel like an anti-immigration sentiment, we saw protests around the country, was very much to the surface and part of media coverage versus this time around, how much did that anti-immigration sentiment and narrative feature in your own analysis and reporting and what you were seeing offline and online?
Yeah, so in after the June elections, we put out a similar piece of research that documented 36 incidents. Now, the nature and scale of violence, harassment and other forms of intimidation during the general election was markedly different. In general, there was less on-the-ground targeting and more efforts concentrated online. In this instance, immigration was a major issue during the locals, but it didn't feature in the general election campaign. It didn't have the same, I suppose, topic saliency. But there may be less space in general elections for these kinds of anti-immigrant narratives to gain a foothold. The threshold for getting elected is higher, of course, too. So candidates must set out their stall and appeal to issues that, that voters care about. But at the core of a lot of the targeting of candidates or canvassers was this type of anti-immigrant sentiment. So figures from parties who are perhaps perceived as more progressive or liberal or supportive of immigration were routinely targeted. Also, candidates of a migrant background were targeted both in June elections but also in the general elections. And we saw racist abuse, anti-Muslim slurs, things like this. And then targeting of incumbent politicians, frequent use of the term traitor by candidates running in this election to refer to those candidates who are seen as supportive of immigration. So it really ran right to the core of it.
And in the era of misinformation, disinformation, where there can be a lot of just trying to sow confusion, I guess, Kieran O'Connor with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, even in the days since Friday, how much of a playbook have you seen when it has come to claims, conspiracy theories of election counting and how that whole process has played out? Has that, have you seen kind of a lot of querying online, or is that dissipated a little bit compared to locals and Europeans as well?
We saw it in the locals, and we have seen it since Friday before ballots were, before counting of ballots even began. There was questions or even conspiracies around ballot security, how were ballots being secured overnight, these kinds of things. Generally, it hasn't broken through, thankfully, but what you're seeing there is a complete import of narratives from the US, in particular election denial claims that seek to target the integrity of the election. And as you say there, there really is a playbook there that time and time again, it's candidates from the far right spectrum that are crying foul, that are raising concerns over things like ballot security, the number of migrant voters who maybe voted in this election for the first time, or even queries around voter ID. And there are some fundamental issues with our own voter management system in terms of polling cards and things like this. And it's within those kinds of questions and anxieties that people have that they play upon, exactly.
But generally not cutting through. Okay, well, thank you for all of that analysis. Kieran O'Connor, Senior Analyst with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, for joining us on that. Back to studio here, Paul Hosford of the Irish Examiner. When we talk about a playbook there from places like the United States, and we've seen it world over, one of the other things that will probably focus minds from the United States here in Ireland is going to be the inauguration day of January 20th of Donald Trump. Do you think that is a date to which will focus minds when it comes to government formation, starting to get a lot of new Fine Gael TDs into position and ready to go for a new government? Or do you think January 20th is too ambitious?
I'm not entirely sure that it's doable, I suppose, but the numbers that have come back today make it more possible. Speaking over the weekend, Pascal Donoghue said Christmas. Jack Chambers very quickly kind of said that's not happening. The Dáil will meet on the 18th. You'll have your token nominees for Taoiseach. We in 2020, I think Micheál Martin, Leo Varadkar, Eamon Ryan and Marilyn McDonald were put forward. I think you come back from that and you maybe start the weekend after the new year and get really into the talks. But the fact is that the manifestos that were put forward aren't massively different between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And we assume that will be the starting point for serious talks. So a programme for government shouldn't be too difficult to agree. Everyone talks about parity of esteem, and nobody wants to talk about what parity of esteem.
How do you define parity of esteem tonight, Paul Hosford?
Now, I think in my head, parity of esteem is that everyone is treated the same.
Yeah.
I don't know how you treat two parties the same when one has 48 seats and one has 38. There's not necessarily a senior and junior partner there, but there is kind of a senior and vice senior party there. I think there's parity of esteem. We can all go in and pretend that we're friends, but there's reality.
One has more cabinet seats than the other.
Yeah, I think that's probably the easiest way. I spoke to a Fianna Fáil strategist over the weekend who said that if those were the numbers, he wouldn't be offering a rotating Taoiseach. And if Fine Gael insisted on the Taoiseach's office, then he would insist on finance for the full 5 years, or, you know, additional cabinet seats. You kind of have to show that you have the most seats. It has to mean something. It can't just be, you know, pretend that we're equal because we got to 86. Because as many in Fianna Fáil saw it over the weekend, it wasn't that we got to 46, it was we got to 48 and you got to 38. And that's the reality of it. So I think that the actual negotiations on the programme will be relatively easy. I think the structure might be more complicated this time around.
And the common ground that they have is that they have now ultimately been trusted on the economy. Again, when we go back to that exit poll, and given the last 5 years, there definitely seems to be a lot of commonalities there on the economy and housing. And I suppose on that, Kevin Cunningham, to bring you back in from Ireland Thinks, you were listening to Kieran O'Connor there, going through some of the influences of so-called right-wing or anti-immigration candidates and how that played out online and offline. And, you know, when you reflect, I suppose, on, again, exit poll, we talked about the economy, housing, immigration, you know, and how that played out. Can you talk a little bit about what you were seeing in the data, how much that featured in people's decision on candidates, and maybe then voter intentions? Is there anything we can learn about how people voted by race or nationality in this general election?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head as well, Áine, just to very briefly mention something about the economy as an issue. So one of the things you did was ask people what they thought was the most important issue in terms of determining their vote a week before the election, and then on polling day itself. And what was really quite interesting about this data, and I was only just looking at it today, was how the issue of the economy rose quite sharply particularly in that last week. And it was an issue, obviously, that was emphasised very strongly by Fine Gael, and particularly in terms of trying to shore up its vote. It shifted from 12% identifying the economy as the issue that determined their vote to 19%, which is quite a jump, to be honest with you. But in terms of immigration, obviously that is the issue that for the entire year, as you said, we've been kind of tracking, very closely connected to support for the radical right. And it is worth remarking upon that, as was discussed earlier, back in May, 47% of people identified this as a top issue. But by November, this halved to around 23%. And you can see this reflected in the results, really. You know, the kind of radical right parties who collectively got 4.9% in the European elections only got 1.5%. So they actually declined quite significantly in this particular election. They had a very poor day out in relative terms, and I actually thought they were going to have a much better result for them, partly because when it comes to general elections, you do get a slightly larger turnout and the type of voter that wouldn't necessarily vote in a local but might vote in a general election. So those turnout differences might have actually, you might have thought, helped them. But yeah, the issue of immigration is a really interesting one. In terms of the parties themselves, AIM2 supporters tend to be much more likely to emphasise it. From the exit poll, we saw 24% of those that supported AIM2 tended to believe that was the issue determining their vote. And obviously these radical right parties, 33%, but also independents as well, a little bit more likely than the average to identify the issue.
Then it was going as low as what, 6% on average?
6%, sorry, yeah, 6% in the exit poll, which is interesting. Now, I had slightly different numbers, but again, there was a decline over the course of the campaign in terms of the relative importance. It went from, you know, the third most important issue to the kind of fifth or sixth most important issue. And I think it's just as everything sort of squeezed on other issues, and the economy tended to be the focus. I think people were, maybe the coverage was changing a little bit. I mean, maybe over the past couple of months that immigration issue has kind of subsided for some people. I mean, some of it, it's worth saying that, you know, when we do these polls on this particular issue, that Irish attitudes are, generally speaking, far more progressive, if I can use that term, when it comes to the issue of immigration. Okay. Particularly the oldest generation If you were to compare the kind of 65 plus Irish voter to their British counterpart, or certainly their Dutch or Austrian counterpart, Irish retirees are actually quite progressive, particularly on this particular issue, which is kind of an interesting artifact, I think, and maybe something that sets us out from other countries.
Well, Kevin Cunningham, founder of Ireland Thinks and lecturer in politics at TU Dublin, you have served us very well for the last 3 days in and out of a lot of RTE studios. Now that we do have 174 seats filled, I hope you can go and get some deserved sleep and rest and recharge.
Thank you very much for everything, Kevin.
Suzanne Rogers, Social Justice Ireland, bring you in there. Given everything we've talked about tonight, and you talked about, you know, looking at the manifestos and even searching for words like poverty, and as you think about single parent families tonight, when you think about homelessness, when you think about children being raised in poverty, I suppose where do you have hope? Where do you see commonalities when you listen to Paul talk about the various different permutations, when you hear about maybe independents being kingmakers or maybe the Labour Party? Where would you like to see this conversation and debate play out in the weeks to come as a government is formed?
If I pick the word economy, what's the point of a functioning economy is to have a society. So it isn't, it's about, like, it is the economy stupid, but at the same time, what is the point of all of this wealth and making money if it isn't about, as you said, providing homes, providing adequate childcare, providing, you know, every summer we're seeing headlines where there's children who don't have school places. We are about to enter our annual trolley crisis headline. So it will be like, what is the point of this economic success if it isn't about creating a functioning society that allows us all to flourish? So I really want to see, that's what I really want to see the focus on is, you know, income adequacy, safe, secure, affordable homes, access to childcare. And I think, you know, when we talk about where the vote went and people looking for change, there has been a shot across the bows. You know, there is a big section, like there's a big subsection of people who are very, very dissatisfied with things. And I was reading on the bus this morning, Poverty Safari by Darren McGarvey, as most policy wonks tend to do at 7:30 in the morning. But like, I've only just started it, but like, he's talking about, like, he's Scottish, he's talking about the UK, and he's talking about, like, communities regarded as deprived, where there is a pathological suspicion of outsiders and of the authorities, where there's a deeply ingrained belief that there's no point in participating in a democratic process because people in power do not care about the concerns of the underclass. We really need to be careful here. I think we need to tackle poverty, we need to tackle inequality, because I wonder where the next general election will bring us if we don't actually have you know, the wherewithal and the courage, I think, to be really, really brave, really ambitious with our policies.
So give us that final call to action in 10 seconds to politicians, policymakers listening tonight.
They're going to have to spend the money. They're going to have to really, like, you know, show us what they're talking about. And I think look at those who are furthest behind. I said those silk figures in January are going to be very revealing.
OK, well, that was the last word to Suzanne Rogers, policy analyst with Social Justice Ireland. My thanks also to Paul Hosford, Deputy Political Editor with the Irish Examiner here in studio. That is all we have time for tonight on day 3, where we finally filled all 174 seats. My thanks to Mary Elizabeth Bruton, who was our broadcast coordinator. Research was by Niamh Dunn. James Feeney was on sound. Tonight's programme was produced by our series producer, Penny Hart. Up next here on RTÉ Radio 1, it's Colin Murray with Late Debate. Thanks for joining us.